A couple of the key things I do want to point, the farm is treated as a factory with inputs and outputs, right? You put in your fertilizer, you put in your seed, you put in, you know, different types of fuels and stuff like that, and out comes chickens, out comes cows, out comes, you know, wheat, all that type of stuff. Heavily dependent on synthetic fertilizers, pesticides, etc. And it's a primary source of food, right? Feeding the world. So we're going to dig into this. So what are the pros? There are actually a lot of pros, right? It's cheap food, right? We've totally revolutionized and created very cheap food, economies of scale, increased yields. We'll talk about the whole green revolution. And what that did, and you know, we do big, massive amounts of exporting now as well, right? The cons, there are a lot of cons from the environmental perspective, soil depletion, huge dependency on oil, and we'll show you what some of those dependencies look like. We got these genetically modified organisms in there, the GMOs, synthetic fertilizers, pesticides. So there's a kind of a mixture of it out there. Go ahead. So let's do a little history of kind of what got us into the industrial agriculture model, if you will. So back in 08, a couple of Germans, they figured out how to take airborne nitrogen and turn that into fertilizer, effectively, the Haber-Bosch process. We had the Dust Bowl, you know, severe drought, and we had deep plowing that occurred in the prior decade or two. So basically, you had no root structure left anymore in the plains, right? So you had this huge erosion, so they had to go through and fix that. Big thing we had was World War II, right? We had all these chemical industries basically producing explosives and whatnot for the Department of Defense. Well, they need something to do in peacetime, right? So what they did is they got together with some of the USDA agronomists and basically said, hey, we can turn that whole industry into fertilizer production and start feeding our fields with it. And so that's really what happened there. We also started having the speedy service system of the McDonald's and the White Castles and whatnot. So trying to really commoditize food and see how quickly you can get it out there. You know, focus on quantity and speed versus quality. Next. We had the Green Revolution. Has everyone heard of the Green Revolution? Right? Norman Borlaug, they increased the yield per bushel, basically, by doing these hybrid seeds. We have these farm bills. You know, every 5 years, we have this big omnibus bill that comes through that passes all the farm policies, so you get all these subsidies, primarily for a lot of the bigger industries out there. And then we had, you know, Secretary Earl Butz come through in the 70s, basically saying, get bigger, get out. And that's where the whole emphasis was on industry, right? Either you're going to be a 100,000 acre farm or you're not going to be a farm. And that really, you could look at the statistics and just see the you know, precipitous drop in the number of farms in the U.S. as a result. Okay, but here was the effects of the Green Revolution right here, right? Tremendous increase in the yield. This is, you know, for wheat, the bushels per acre they are also able to get, you know, sitting there about 12 or 13, all the way up through, you know, the Green Revolution, then it's just skyrocketed up. Now they're getting upwards of 44, 45, you know, bushels per acre.
If it's irrigated, it's 125.
What's that?
If it's irrigated, it's 125 bushels per acre.
Yeah, I don't know. That's the best data I've got from USDA.
But those are dry land.
Yeah, it could be. You're probably
don't
right.
Don't forget the ability of modern machinery able to harvest all this faster.
Sure. Sure.
Not just the growth, but be able to harvest it.
Sure, sure. And so, but then there's also, so, you know, there's kind of a balancing act that's trying to be played out here, right? If you look at the UN estimates for the population, so we're seeing a 7 billion now. By 2050, they basically say we're going to be at 9.3 billion. But what they're also projecting is that we're going to have a huge calorie gap, basically. Per person, they anticipate that we'll be 900 calories short per person to be able to feed them. And I don't remember what the exact number is, but what their target levels are. It's like 15 or 2,000 calories per day, but they anticipate about 900 calorie per person per day shortage in terms of food production.
So right now there's not a gap, right?
Right now there's not a gap, right? But they're projecting that out based on the population growth. And you can look at the population growth and guess what it looks like. It's very exponential. Here's something that's pretty important. This is just a correlation between big oil, or, you know, oil and big egg, right? So as your oil prices go up, your food prices go up.
I got lost on this, the calorie gap thing.
Calorie gap.
You said right now there is none?
There is
none. Worldwide?
Worldwide.
We could.
There's twice as much food available today.
There is actually.
It's just that we're not distributing it.
Distribution mechanisms.
Okay, thank you.
Some are hoarding, we're hoarding.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
It's, yeah, the 2050 timeframe with the other 1.7 billion people, that's when they anticipate we'll have a food shortage. And obviously it'd build up, I mean, it's just not all of a sudden gonna occur, it's gonna build up over time. Here we just see, we have, you know, just plotting some basic numbers here, you see very, pretty good correlation between, you know, when oil prices go up, food prices go up, because it's so heavily oil dependent, whether it's your machinery, whether it's your fertilizer costs, it's all driven by cheap oil.
Transportation to get to market.
Transportation, all that stuff, it's all driven by cheap oil. And what, here's another interesting one, some people at the New England Complexity Institute, we're looking at, okay, when the food price index goes up, what happens to regional stability around the world? And so what you're seeing here are instances of regional stability, and in the brackets or in the prints are the number of people killed in all those instabilities. And so as your food prices hit, you know, that 200 plus level, all of a sudden your number of instabilities around the world just starts skyrocketing. So that's a little bit disconcerting right there, obviously. Let's go to the next slide. Shifting a little bit here, here's...
Hold on. Can you go back to that last one and explain it a little bit more?
Yeah, please.
It's basically saying, so this is, the UN puts out, the Food and Agriculture Organization, which is the UN's big food group, basically they create this food price index, which looks at like price of goods. They do kind of an aggregate of the different price of goods out there. And so they come up with this FPI, this food price index. Basically what these folks did then, these were some economists basically back in Boston area. They went and looked, took that data, and then they compared it to different instabilities that were occurring around the world, different types of wars or conflicts that were basically occurring around the world. And they tried to show if there's a correlation or not between those things. And so basically what they're showing here is that, you know, as the food price index was skyrocketing, you start getting all of these different instabilities occurring, and then the numbers in parentheses just represent the number of deaths that occurred for those different instabilities. So you see places like...
So the bar part is are the deaths, and the graph is the food price?
The bars just represent the existence of an instability. In Somalia, 5 people died, is what it's saying there. And, you know, Tunisia, 300 people died. So these are like riots that would be occurring in these places.
Riots.
Right, over food.
Okay.
So here's something else interesting. We talked a little bit about economics the other day, right? So here's something, the food bubble. This is an interesting article by Frederick Kaufman. So Goldman Sachs in 91, right, Goldman doing what it does, it wants to create money, right? And so what they did is they created these commodity index, basically, where they bundled together commodifiable goods like coffee and cattle and stuff like that. They began to sell these, and they started doing well. Other investment firms picked up and started doing the same thing. A couple of economists came out in 2005 and basically said, hey, look, commodities are basically as safe as equities. If you try to use this type of commodities index historically over the past 50 years, and that there was basically a negative correlation with equities. So as stocks go up, you know, commodities typically go down, and vice versa, right? And so what that did was that spurred a lot of people to start investing in the commodities. Because before it was very risky business for people to get into commodities. Now all of a sudden it kind of reduced the risk, and hundreds of billions of dollars got dumped into the commodities, or into the commodities market here. People started speculating with it. All of a sudden we had a food bubble. And the irony here is the supply, well, it's not like the supply was limited. The supply was always the same. However, food prices skyrocketed, in particular the hard red spring wheat. Run out of, you know, the Minneapolis Grain Exchange, the price is skyrocketing. So if you go to the next slide, there's your spike right there. So you have the price of, you know, red spring wheat basically shoot way up to, it's like $425, you know, dollars per metric ton is what it's showing right there. But basically what it did is it put 250 million people in the world all of a sudden entered the, what do they call it? Oh, hang on.
Food insecurity.
Yeah, food insecure list basically. They were basically starving as a result because they couldn't afford, you know, the food prices skyrocketed so much, and all because of speculation in the marketplace, because of these commodity indexes that they created. And you know, what's scary to me is you start seeing past that, and you see the prices going, you know, jumping back up. I don't remember what the current, yeah, that one doesn't show the current, well, there's a current food price indexes, so they're still quite high. But they are dropping some now. So it's another one of those financial instruments, basically, that because it allows people to speculate on it, you know, while they can make or lose money, I mean, 250 million people were basically starving as a result of that.
Can you explain that commodity speculation stuff? How does that work?
So they basically took, and I don't claim to be a total expert on this, so I'll give my best explanation. I mean, it's kind of like what we talked about the other day, where when you take mortgages, you bundle them up, you securitize them, right? So they took, you know, like I said, cattle, coffee, these different things, bundle them up, and so you can basically buy an index. So it's an index fund into commodities, is what it is.
When you buy an index.
You buy an index, right?
What is an index?
So an index is like the S&P 500, right? It's a grouping of stocks out there. And you can buy an S&P 500 index that basically tries to track how the S&P 500 rises and falls. So or the Dow Jones, there are Dow Jones indices out there, right? So there are 30 stocks in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, right? The big ones like IBM and stuff like that, right? I don't know who else is on there, Home Depot, stuff like that. Big stocks are on there, right? What an index fund does is basically, you know, it's like, say I'm a Fidelity investment broker, right? And so say I run the Dow Jones Industrial Average Index Fund, right? So what I'm doing is I'm buying and selling, you know, quantities of those 30 stocks to try to track what the Dow Jones average does. That's effectively what an index fund does. So what they did here was they just did that not for stocks, not for equities, they did it for commodities now. For cattle, you know, corn, hogs, wheat, all that sort of thing.
Is the advantage of an index that when you group things together like that, if, I don't know, if there was a drought in coffee land and coffee didn't do very well, all your eggs aren't in one basket, right? Basically?
Yeah, it's more diversified portfolio. Yeah. But you're able to do it by just being able to buy one thing as opposed to having to buy all 30 stocks, for instance. So it makes it easier. And what a lot of people will do with these index funds, you know, is they'll just continue every month. They'll buy, you know, if I'm going to spend $500 a month on investing, okay, I just put that on the index fund. Just keep doing it regardless of what the price is, because you're just trying to average it out over time. You're in it for kind of the long haul.
So then investing in that, essentially what you're trying to do is suck some money out of that product.
The best I can understand is they were trying to make it so that commodities didn't appear as risky to people. And so people would buy more of those things. When in reality, commodities can be risky. But they were trying to, remember that little equation where we had the housing market equation, where they tried to reduce the risk by having a simple little calculation, saying your risk is low here, right? They're trying to do something similar here with the commodity indexes.
So when you invest in a commodity, of course you hope you're going to make money. But when you make money, somebody else in the world is going to starve because they can't afford to buy it.
That's what happened here.
I mean, isn't that basically what happens when you invest in commodities?
Well,
you hope to make money.
What they think happened here was people thought someone was trying to corner the market, right? And so everyone was trying to get in on the action, which started driving the price way up. And they got that spike. And honestly, I don't know exactly what caused the bubble for it to drop back down. But something burst, you know, it just got to a climax and it burst and it dropped at that point. And so then it fell back. But in the meantime, like I said, the problem is that you had, like I said, 250 million people basically starving as a result of people speculating on Wall Street.
Right, and so the investment process is not one of joining together, using my funds to enhance this product over the long. If you only stay in long enough that I can make some money and get out.
It's making a buck.
And the irony is,
the big banks like this, they're making bucks every which way, right? Because they are, every time you buy a contract for, you know, Red Spring Wheat, they're charging a little transaction.
Commission.
Coming and going each way. So they're just continually racking up all those fees along the way.
Just like lawyers.
So their claim that commodity indexes are as safe as equities, is that true for investors, or is that just something that's pretty, like an equation that's really not?
Is it true? Personally, I don't think it's true, right? I mean, this was an academic study that came out of a guy from Penn, University of Pennsylvania, and Yale, and they were claiming, and everyone kind of glummed on that and said, yeah, this is great. Now all of a sudden we kind of have, it's not as risky, right? They look historically for like 40 years to say, hey, if we looked at the commodity prices, if they were actually in this index fund, they would have been just as safe as like being in the stock market. I haven't actually read the paper, so I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'd have to go back and dig. I don't know. Do we have any commodities investors in here?
Saying something as safe as equities is sort of like, equities have never been.
The other thing is, I don't know about commodities, but obviously in the equity side, you know, there are different classes of risk in the equity side, right? You could be doing, penny stocks, or you could be doing, kind of the Johnson & Johnson type stuff that typically are very stable over the long period. So I suspect there are similar things on the commodity side as well.
You get an unknown in food commodities in that weather is unpredictable.
You
so
do.
That's kind of a wild card.
Yeah. Which I think, and they were trying to kind of reduce that risk, right? That was one of the things they were trying to say is, hey, because you're not really sure, are we going to have a drought this year? We're going to have great rain? What's the temperature going to be like? A lot of, I think Wall Street was hesitant to get into that market, but then all of a sudden Goldman came forward with this, hey, we've got this new financial instrument, right? We did some financial engineering again, came up with these good indexes, and then it drove the speculation. So, okay, next slide. So we have the spike. So I can show you a 5-minute clip, or we can just keep going, of a little movie clip. It's a little propaganda-ish, and so I don't want to taint you, but I will show it if you'd like to see a movie clip. It's basically on the loss of soil in industrial agriculture. You want to see it?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll show it. Like I said, there's a little, I don't have a
sound.
Is there a plug for sound?
Yeah, there is a plug for sound.
Can I think you want it?
So who made the film?
It's the Environmental Working Group. It's a nonprofit in DC. But like I said, it's a little, there's some actual good facts in here, but it's a little it's a little provocative, I think. Actually, let's do this.
Responsible farming practices are putting our land and our water at risk. Gully scar farm fields, washing away precious topsoil, creating a direct pipeline delivering mud, toxic farm chemicals, and bacteria to our streams, rivers, and eventually our drinking water supplies. Farmers pushing to get every bushel out of every acre are planting crops fence row and right up to stream banks. Mud, chemical fertilizers, pesticides, and even crops themselves end up in our water when millions of acres of farm fields bleed soil and polluted runoff. Federal officials estimate that soil erosion in Iowa averages about 5 tons per acre per year. People say that's reassuring because conventional wisdom holds that the land can lose that much without too much damage. But a report by the Environmental Working Group called Losing Ground reveals that erosion is actually much worse than that. The group used information by Iowa scientists using new techniques that estimate how much soil is lost after each storm. In 2009, for example, some storms triggered soil losses as much as 100 tons per acre. That's 20 times greater than the reported average. 40%, nearly half of Iowa's fields, lost more than the statewide average, and the damage adds up year after year. If we had the same storm-by-storm detail for the whole country, the picture would be even more alarming. Without an area of grass between crops and water, pesticides, fertilizers, and manure run directly into our rivers, streams, and drinking water. It renders our water undrinkable, our beaches unfit to swim in, and has created an area in the Gulf so contaminated that aquatic life has to flee or die. Some farmers are doing the best they can to protect our soil and water. They plant grass strips to heal gullies. They use trees and grass as a buffer between our streams and the crop fields where they apply the pesticides and fertilizers. These farmers are our conservation heroes and are living proof that farmers and the environment can prosper together. Meanwhile, Washington makes life tougher for conservation-minded farmers by pushing them to plant fence row to fence row with little consideration for what happens to our land. For over the past decade, Washington has paid out $250 billion in federal farm subsidies. In 2008 alone, Corn Belt farmers received nearly $3 billion in subsidies as incentives to grow as much corn and soybeans as possible. Federal programs that pay farmers to repair gullies and install buffers between streams and their fields are chronically underfunded and just can't stand up to the pressure for all-out production. Instead of helping farmers protect our land, taxpayers send out big checks to the largest and wealthiest landowners. And most of the checks aren't going to struggling family farmers. In fact, the household income of people getting the biggest checks was $210,000, three times the national average. You don't even need to be a farmer to get a check. You just have to own the farmland. The more corn and soybeans they grow, the more taxpayer subsidies they receive. Not exactly an incentive to leave a part of that land unplanted to stop erosion. Even if it means the rest of us and the environment pay the price. It's time the government starts enforcing the law that requires farmers to put conservation practices in place in exchange for the billions of dollars of taxpayer income and insurance subsidies they get every year from taxpayers. Farmers need a safety net, but so do our land and water. If you'd like to stop dangerous farm chemicals...
Alright, so that's that.
So is this the bottom of the satisfaction quotient right now on that first one?
Hang on, we're getting close. No, actually, we have a little further to go yet. We're still dropping pretty quickly. So this was that soil loss that they were showing. And this really was kind of a first of a kind that I've seen of where they really actually did scientifically went out and tried to measure this, right? And again, they really only did it for Iowa. And so you even heard during that video that they haven't done it kind of nationwide. But you can see, you know, those ones in red were getting 50 to 100 tons of loss per acre. That's a lot of soil. If you take just a, what was it? I think I went into the calculation. If you take the 5 tons, they basically say 5 tons per year per acre is satisfactory. That's okay if we lose that, right? If you take that 5 tons of soil and spread it across the acre, I think it was going to be like the width of like a dime, effectively, of soil. But it takes nature like 100 years to grow about an inch of soil. So it's just like we're kind of in a losing proposition of depleting our soil resources. You hear about peak oil. Peak soil is like a big issue out there. Right, because we're flushing it down the drain, basically, what we're doing. Because we've kind of destroyed the root structure. There's really nothing in those fields anymore. We've destroyed the structure. We're doing simply annual grains and soybeans. And when you get the runoff, it flushes off to the pesticides, the fertilizer, right down the chute. It goes down the Mississippi and hits basically the Gulf of Mexico. Let's go to the next slide. And it basically creates a dead zone. And so here we just got a graphic from NOAA that basically shows the darker red it is, the more deoxygenated it is, meaning, you know, aquatic life cannot live there. And that's basically just due to all the runoff that's coming from the Corn Belt area. And so it's a serious problem.
Well, it decimates the estuaries, which are the birthplace of all ocean life. If we don't have the estuaries,
I mean,
that doesn't just affect that area. That's going to affect a whole lot bigger area.
Right. Let's go to the next slide. So we're still dropping a little bit on our happiness curve. Drought is another real problem, right? All of a sudden there's been some, you know, we've heard about like some of the drought conditions in the Southwest. Well, there have been some early reports coming out saying, hey, it's looking like we're going to have chronic drought in the Southwest for the next 50 years. And that there's really no end in sight. And so, again, people are just very concerned about that. Okay, how does that impact, you know, what does that do to the overall environment then? If I think I go to the next slide. yeah, here is a current drought monitor that, this is in Nebraska where they monitor this, but, you know, showing current drought conditions, basically. And so you can see that part of the southwest region there is just in exceptionally bad state. Next slide. So let's talk a little bit more about warming. We hear a lot about global warming. Let's talk about some of the ways by which people go and do the measurements. So these are kind of coming from NOAA. People know what NOAA is, right? National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They kind of call out 10 different areas by which we can start kind of measuring warming out there. And I'll talk about a couple of these. We'll talk about sea ice a little bit. We'll talk about the temperature over land and over the oceans. And then we'll talk about, what's the other one I'm going to talk about? Those are the ones we'll talk about, actually. Let's go to the next slide. Oops. Got a quick finger there, kiddo. There we go. Okay. So one thing is, let's talk about Antarctic ice core stations. So they basically, they do boreholes in Antarctica, right? And you can go back, recently it was only about to 400,000 years ago, but now they can actually get back to about 800,000 years ago and actually calculate both temperature and carbon dioxide concentration levels. Carbon dioxide concentration levels and then temperature rate readings for those yearly, for those different years. And just showing here are basically the different stations from which they do their typical measurements. I'll show you some measurements from Dome C here. Let's go to the next slide. Can you read that? Probably the only thing I'd say on this one is you see, you know, very kind of cyclical things. So those get you into the ice ages, basically, right? You'll notice over on that column shows us our carbon dioxide parts per million. So that's kind of the typical measurement they do. So, you know, if you have a million molecules of atmosphere and you have, you know, one part per million, that basically says you have one carbon dioxide molecule in those million molecules. And so typically this is varied anywhere from kind of 170, which is down here, all the way up to, you know, about less than 300 has been basically the level for the past 800,000 years. Right, that's a big measurement. So let's go to the next slide. So I'm going to come back to that one a little bit. Here's kind of what we're seeing in terms of some of the temperature anomalies. So you couldn't really see it on the previous slide because there's so much data, but here you see what they did was they basically did an average from like 1951 to 1980, which was pretty much a constant temperature. And then they've showed kind of the where we are at 2011. We're showing changes from that 1951 to 1980 average. And so you can see, especially in the poles, you have really severe heating going on, right? So you have like a 4.4 degrees Celsius increase in temperature over the poles alone. Next slide. And then this actually shows some of the values. So again, here's kind of that average value that they're talking about from 51 to 80, where basically averaged out, and they say they call that zero, and then they start measuring deviations from that. So globally, what they're saying is that we've had about a, you know, 0.55 increase, 0.55 Celsius degree increase globally since about the 80s. Next slide. Want to show you just real briefly here. These are the global carbon dioxide emissions. And so remember we talked about exponential growth as well? We talked about that regression factor that measures the goodness of fit when you plot that. Well, here we get a regression factor of 0.98. It's a great fit for an exponential curve. So we basically see our carbon dioxide emissions growing exponentially as well. Next slide. And then we talked about that concentration level of parts per million. I mentioned how we went from 170 to 300, right? Hey, just last month we hit 400 parts per million for the globe. So, you know, we're basically 100 parts per million greater than it's ever been in the last 800,000 years. So it's not a really good thing. Most scientists will claim we need to be at like 350 parts per million or lower to kind of avoid severe shocks to the system.
Did you just say we're higher than we have been for the last how many thousand years?
800,000.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we're 100 points higher. So we're basically, you know what, 33% higher than we've ever been for the last 800,000 years globally. So, yeah, and so... Here's an interesting factoid, though, right? There is still uncertainty about what occurs first, temperature rise or carbon dioxide levels. And right now, it appears that temperature rising is what occurs first. And they narrowed it down. You used to have a window about, it was, you know, kind of within a 1,400-year window as to what occurred first, or how much CO2 emissions might lag the temperature but now I think they've backed up to about 200 years. But it still appears that temperature rises first and carbon dioxide emissions follow that. So there's a lag, actually. So it's not a causal thing, necessarily. But it's when you see that, you're getting that effect. So as our carbon dioxide emissions going, I mean, we're probably going to see temperatures go up as well, I suspect. But there's a weird causality thing going on there, which no one really understands right now. Next slide. So what are our results? I think I've already talked about those. Again, the 800,000 years, that was kind of pre-1813. So it was like, you know, 700, it was a huge number, 796,000 BC to like 1813. That's where the CO2 levels were, between 170 and 300. And then post was, you know, we just hit 400 last month. What does it do? You know, results, you get the shrinking ice caps. So 39% sea loss over the last 20 years, 30 years, I guess, 28 years. Next slide. I just had to throw this slide in there. I thought that was kind of funny. So the right side, another big issue of industrial agriculture is monoculture, right? So the right side, you have monoculture. You basically, they pretty much destroy the land. They're going to plant all corn right there. The problem when you do that is you have no biodiversity, right? So if you get an infestation of something, it's going to wipe out your entire crop.
Yeah, 100%.
Right. Whereas if you're like the guy on the right or on the left, he's got all types of crops that he's growing, right? So an infestation of something will only wipe out probably a small portion of those crops, right? So the right side lacks resilience, is the bottom line. The left side has resilience. But what's interesting, this was in Orion magazine, which is kind of an environmental magazine, but the guy on the right-hand side, the farmer there, was basically saying, this gentleman on the left, he was a dirty farmer because it wasn't clean, nicely plowed fields and all that sort of thing. Which is kind of funny, I think.
So the guy on the left has bundled commodities.
He bundled them up, exactly. I think he's got a bundle of rosemary in his hand right now. That's what he's got.
So. Well, and here's the other kicker. If some of their bio-modified seed falls on his land and he inadvertently harvests it, they're going to sue him, too.
Well, so did you just heard about the ruling with Monsanto?
What was the ruling?
Monsanto won.
Oh, my gosh.
Patent rights, right? That was in May, so yeah. So let's go to the next slide. Okay, so where are we? We're in the dumps right now, right? We're in Kierkegaardian despair, so now we're gonna climb out. You ready? Okay, here we go. So, next slide, girl. Okay, so what are some good things going on out there, right? Farmers markets, those are a great thing, right? We've seen a dramatic increase in farms, not quite exponential, we'll work on that one, but there's been a big increase in farmers' markets, right? So, you know, local farmers get involved, bringing stuff right to people, right? So you cuts out the middleman, you get fresh food. These are good things. I mean, I hope you all partake in them as you can, obviously. Next, community-supported agriculture. It's another huge boon out there. CSA farms are great. I mean, we've done a bunch of them, and we love them. And I mean, it's great. You know, you pay $500 or whatever it is, and for the next, you know, 20 weeks or so, I get a great box of fresh veggies and, you know, stuff like that. And what's also good is, not only is it really fresh, but it kind of forces you out of your comfort zone. You're getting, like, Diacons or whatever these things were. These weird things. It's just like, what do you do with this thing, right? But it expands your palate. It's just, it's good all around. And you know, I mean, when we were in Boston, we had a great relationship with our farmers. We'd go out there and have, you know, strawberry shortcake festivals and stuff like that. It's a great way to connect with the farming community thing. The other thing is, we've had a precipitous drop, according to the Census Bureau, of the number of farmers, until about a year or two ago, when we actually had a slight rise in the number of farmers in the U.S. And you can even see here, this line right here shows us the number of farms. You even see, you start getting down here, we're still dropping. It kind of stabilizes, and it starts increasing again in 2007. So you've actually started to grow our farming population a bit. And a lot of it is because of the CSA movement and these farmers markets, and, you know, a lot of the younger farmers are getting in that business now. But there still is a big concern that most of the farmers are still aging. You know, I think the average age was like 58 or 59 of most of the farmers out there. And so they're really concerned about, okay, what's going to happen when those folks retire?
This is a U.S.?
Yeah, this is from the Census Bureau. This is just U.S. So that's another good thing. Let's go to the next slide. Here's another interesting one. So there's an institute called the Land Institute in Kansas that is doing some really interesting work on perennial grains. And so My wife's laughing at me. She thinks I'm crazy with all this grain stuff. But so there's a guy, Jerry Glover, another guy, Wes Jackson, who is really the head of the Land Institute. But they're trying to, basically what you're seeing here is, you know, they went and did the tillage of all the plains, right? And they tilled everything. They went with annual plants, right? Well, the problem is the root depth never got very large, right? If you're tilling it every year, you only get to be about a foot root of depth in your root. Well, what these guys are experimenting with are perennial grains, so types of wheat cultivars that will live perennially. You don't till anymore, right? This thing will grow back, it'll be perennials, it'll grow back every year. You'll get seed every year. And so, but you see the root structure, right? I mean, these root structures go down like 8 to 10 feet. And so all of a sudden, you bind in the soil, and you don't get as much erosion. You don't get the soil loss in.
And so, they talk about water in these types of situations?
In these types of situations? So in these types of situations, these actually hold water much better than the annuals.
Much less runoff.
Soil is your biggest holder of water, and these things hold in soil. So if you get perennials, you get big fibrous root structures, they hold in soil, holds in water, and that's what gives you kind of the fluffy soil when you have a lot of water in it. So very interesting research. There's still about 10 to 15 years from actually being able to productize these types of grains, though. So it's still a bit out, but they're doing some very good research. Next slide. Okay, so there's also a whole kind of movement called permaculture that's out there. This is a guy, Jeff Lawton. He's an Australian, but he basically, on the left-hand side, well, you're seeing the same place. And this is in the Jordanian desert. It was close to like the Dead Sea, right? Scorching heat, very dry. He basically took 10 acres. They put in swells. They used kind of a permaculture, kind of a holistic design approach for doing lots of mulching, putting in these swells to capture water and recharge the water tables. They planted, you know, brought in some trees and whatnot to plant. But that's after, I don't remember what it is, after like 3 years or so of how they were able to transform that 10 acres in Jordan. And so there are techniques for being able to do that. Let's go to the next slide. Here's another one. I love this example. This is in Bermuda. There's a school down there called the Island School. And Toby Hemingway, who's a big permaculturalist in Portland, Oregon, talks about this in a lecture. But basically, you know, these guys are living on this rocky beach-type environment, right? So what do? They took this little spot, they planted some stuff, they shot all their sewage right out into the place, right? And so there you see when they first planted in the upper right-hand corner. Here's what it looks like 3 months later. That's what it looks like 3 years later. I mean, it's like transforming from a desert to like the Garden of Eden almost, right? I mean, it's just a lush environment all of a sudden. It's because they're using different design techniques for doing that. So there are just a lot of possibilities with some of these design techniques. Next slide. So you think about here in Washington, Chelan, Holden Village, right? That's roughly where you guys are. Isn't that the lake? Mm-hmm. I think. So it's actually zone 5B or 6A, depending upon where we look. Janice and I were talking about this. We were thinking of zone 4. So these are the USDA agricultural zones that tell you kind of like how harsh of environment you have. Well, you know, where we are here, it's like a 5B or a 6A zone. So the colder you get, the harder it is to grow things, basically. So anyways, let's go to the next slide. So what we need to do, or one of the things to think about here is, you know, Janice has been working hard, great garden start, right? But start thinking about how do you start bringing back, you know, there are some things growing here now, but what else could you grow, right? We talked about maybe even doing some hardy, like, you know, fruits and vegetables and stuff like that you could actually grow locally here. There are a bunch of, you know, cherry trees and even apple trees that can grow in, you know, a zone 4 environment. And so, you know, one of the things to start thinking about is how do you start bringing back some of your own local production capabilities? And I think you've got a great start in the garden space, right? I mean, that place gets a ton of sun. You could do a lot out there, actually. By the way, there's a garden party at 4 p.m. tomorrow. Make sure you show up. Next slide. Here's another great thing. So some recent research came out. So I'm working on my PhD in cognitive and neural systems, basically brain modeling work. But these guys came out where they looked at this Mycobacterium vaccae, which is a type of bacteria that basically lives in soil. And what happens is when that soil, when you mix up soil, when you're playing in the dirt, it's releasing this M. vaccae, what they call it for short. M. vaccae then, what it helps you do is actually releases your serotonin neurotransmitters. Serotonin is a good thing for learning. It helps you learn faster, and it's great for decreasing your anxiety. So dig in the dirt. It's good for you, actually. Scientifically proven good for you. So it's something to keep in mind. Next slide. So that's what I have. That's kind of what I can see is a state of affairs with industrial agriculture, some things that are going on that are trying to bring you back up and try to tackle it. It's a hard road ahead, though, because the industrial agriculture system, and it's a revolving door with the government agencies that are supposed to be monitoring them. And yeah, so there's a lot of work to be done. But there are some good signs. I mean, a lot of the younger generation is figuring out, hey, I don't want to eat this, you know, processed industrial food anymore. I want good, healthy food. And they're trying to get more, you know, we see an increase in farmers, we see an increase in the CSAs out there. But there's still a lot more to be done, so.
Did you look into, I can't believe you wouldn't have data that you wouldn't show us, but.
I would never do that, right?
Did you look into how we're losing good agricultural land to development, industrial development, real estate development?
I did not. You asked me about that yesterday, and I failed in my mission to get that for you. I apologize.
I didn't ask.
Maybe someone raised an issue. I have not. It's a great question, though, because, I mean, clearly all the development we do, you see farms going under and getting plowed over.
Hard to bring them back once they're under.
Yeah, they pretty much don't come back at that point. Once you build on them, they're, you know, it's hard to go and remove concrete and pavement and all that sort of thing. It's a really laborious process and expensive.
You could say something about the Lex Farm.
Yeah, I mean, when we lived in Arlington, Mass, before we came to Washington, and there was a local farm in Lexington, Massachusetts, you know, where the shot heard around the world, all that sort of thing occurred, right? And it was a 7-acre farm. It had been there for like 400 years, right? This is like pre-Revolutionary War times. It had been in farming practice, and they were trying to figure out what to do with it. And so we finally convinced the town of Lexington to keep it as a farm. But there was a lot of talk about turning it into like athletic fields, or low-income housing and whatnot. And finally, over a long struggle, we were able to convince them to keep it as a farm. But it's hard to do that. A lot of people don't see the value in it because there isn't a quick buck in it. A lot of people say, hey, oh, we need to house, you know, poor people. And that's a very valid cause, obviously. It's tough to say no, you know, you can't have a house. But there's also something, I mean, one thing about the farming and even like some of these community gardens and whatnot. I mean, that's a whole other sense of community that a lot of places don't get. Holden's obviously different because there's a lot of possibilities for real community gathering, but in a lot of the general towns and populations out there, a lot of people don't get together very, you know, people are very isolated. But some of these community gardens, especially gardens where, you know, a lot of times you get a community garden but everyone has their own plot. But we had one in Arlington where it was a community garden but we all just kind of shared. Everyone just kind of worked together and we all just gardened together. And there's just a lot to be said about kind of growing community that way. I think it's very valuable, but there's a lot to be done there. So what are your thoughts? Good, bad? Ready to do the edible forest gardens here? No more questions?
It's interesting you're talking about CSAs. We belonged to one, we have for several years, but the one we belonged to about 3 years ago, every time you went to pick up your produce, they had a flyer with information on one side and on the other side recipes for many of the things that they were distributing that week.
Yeah.
And that was really great.
I mean, it was great. I mean, to me, it kind of predated the USDA came out with a Know Your Farmer program where they tried to connect, hey, I bought this piece of meat, I want to see from which farm did it come. I don't know how far they ever got, but the CSA model really enabled you to know your farmer. And, you know, kind of care for your farmer a bit. Hey, we had tomato blight. Okay, we're not having tomatoes. That's okay. You know, we'll do something else or whatnot. And, I mean, you profit when it's good and you share the loss as well when things are bad. But I think that's just a great model, I think. Mm-hmm. Right?
Did we just have a Bible study on that? That's Koinonia.
One of the difficulties, though, again, is the whole participation in this kind of stuff is more for the elite. you know, organic foods and access to transportation and you know, input and information that would motivate you to do that.
It certainly is for, I mean, it definitely costs more right now, and a lot of people don't have access to it for a number of reasons.
And the really poor people wouldn't even have any information.
Right. Well, the other, well, go ahead.
In the area where I live in a community with high poverty rate, and the farmer's market really does push food stamps, WICA.
That's a new thing where you can start taking SNAP. You know,
so the folks who have the booths there in the farmer's market are set up to do that.
In fact, I know the Lexington farmer's market, they were doing like a 2-for-1. You buy your food stamps and you get twice as much value out of your food stamps. But it's a good point because it has kind of grown out of, you know, a younger generation that has the knowledge and generally a little bit more money to be able to buy these things. Now, you know, I don't know what to say, but we have to figure out how to spread that more, I think.
And one of the issues, too, has to do with food deserts that are regions where they're low access to food, so the whole issue of distribution, right? The fact that there is enough, but it's not distributed properly.
Right.
And so I worked at a community college in Boston, and there was no place on campus for students to eat, and so there was an entrepreneur decided to go buy Domino's pizzas and bring them to campus, and so that's what our students were eating for breakfast, lunch, and dinner when they were there for the whole day. There was no place for them to walk to get an apple. And we were expecting our students to perform well under those circumstances, and there's just no access. And there are places, too, where there aren't places where people can buy groceries or...
Downtown Tacoma, there's no grocery store.
Yeah, exactly. So that's another serious problem.
Well, I just want to share, maybe you, does it sound like you read O'Ryan? Last year, I think in the last quarter, they had an article that said that for the first time in decades, it's probably like 50-some years, the number of farms in this country rose from 1% instead of shrinking.
Yeah.
So it's really, really slow process, but it is happening.
And you know, it's almost like the destructive power grows exponentially, and the, you know, the growth or the good power for
redemptive.
Yeah, redemptive power grows much slower, right? It's hard to do. I mean, it takes long-term commitment, but there are some signs that it is getting a bit better. But I worry about that stranglehold that the big egg has, and I also worry about kind of the lack of resilience in there, right? I mean, if you look at like Monsanto, right? I mean, they control like 90% of the seed availability in the U.S. I mean, that's not resilience at all.
Is there education, this kind of stuff in our school system in any meaningful way, or is it?
I don't think so.
FFA.
Yeah.
It's gone.
Sponsored by Monsanto.
FFA is very strong in
my community.
Well,
it's not Minnesota.
Yeah.
It's not where I live. It used to be, but not anymore.
Oh, it's big in this state. In the farm communities, it is.
Yeah, and I don't know. I've never been to an FFA program or know what they teach, or if it's just, is it just industrial ag kind of saying this is
what
you do stuff?
I would say not. I can only speak for one small school district, so it's just episodic, it was really teaching the individual kid, yes, the business of farming, but also the stewardship and responsibility.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Good.
Very much involved in the county fair and, you know, selling their animals to the community. The community goes in and buys the animals.
Right.
I did 4-H and I raised a lot of sheep every year, but it was industrial in the sense that we fed it grain for like 4 months, and so it got that fast, and then, you know, then you can sell it.
Right.
We didn't use our own sheep because they were grass-fed, and there's no way they would have been ready. But you do learn, like, responsibility, and you get a little paycheck for the summer, and, you know. Yeah, you do learn about animals in a different way.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, we are 5 minutes over. I don't want to take any more of your time. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.